Asaf, Alex, thank you so much for having me. Thank you also for your flexibility. You know, it's, as the saying goes, Mama said there'll be days like this. She just never said how many. And so today is one of these crazy days. I'm grateful to all of you for accommodating my hectic schedule. And I'm also particularly delighted and honored to be speaking to all of you, because really the work that you do, and I sort of am I'm a lurker on SPME, sort of reading all the mail and communications and updates. And I cannot tell you enough how grateful I am for the work that this organization and its individual members do. I understand very well, as you will soon hear from my own personal story, how thankless and specific the particular fight that you fight, that we fight, is. And I have nothing but the deepest gratitude for anyone who fights it. And so I want to start, as is customary, for people who make a living talking professionally, by talking about that most enticing of subjects, which of course is myself. And I want to tell you a little bit about my journey and how it shaped a lot of the way that I'm thinking, because I think that maybe in it you will find kind of glimpses of truths or provocations that you may find relevant. So I came to this country. I was born in Israel. I came to the United States in 1999 when I was 23 years old. I had a few hundred dollars in my pocket. I'm not particularly proud to report that about half that amount was taken from me about 20 minutes after landing by a sort of shyster cab driver who said, "Come, I'll take you to where you need to go." And, you know, $250 later, I learned a very valuable and costly lesson. But I didn't particularly care, because I had a very distinct dream, and the dream seemed to me like a concrete action plan. And so I landed on Thursday night, and on Friday morning, I took the subway this time to Columbia University. And I stood there and I sort of gazed upon its beauty, that wonderful campus that, you know, was featured in so many famous films like Ghostbusters, and said to myself that really it was all very simple. I had arrived yesterday. I was here today. I will apply tomorrow. And before too long, I will be a graduate student in this university, which means that it will just take a few years until I have some kind of academic job. And from then on in, life would be nothing but a series of cascading pleasures devoted to the exchange of ideas, the life of the mind, and the cultivation of the finest angels of our nature. And I can't hear you, but some of you may be snickering right now. But I'm happy to report that for the longest time, things went precisely according to plan. I applied, I got in, I received my master's in journalism, and then got into the PhD program in communications, and became a teaching fellow, and had a really, really great time, and was really excited about what felt to me like a totally unproblematic, welcoming, warm home. And then there was a little bit of a ripple, a sign of trouble, if you will. A group of Jewish students, led by a person who at the time struck me as sort of fearsome and objectionable, and has since become one of my closest friends on planet Earth, then a young, I think senior, maybe junior, named Barry Weiss, approached the college and argued that there was indeed some sort of, to use current beloved academic terms, systemic bias against pro-Israeli students. And I was at the time a reporter for the Jewish Week of blessed memory, and also, you know, engaged and involved in campus life. And I am not too proud to report, you know, we're just a few weeks away from Yom Kippur, so the time for admitting to and repenting for sins is, you know, the gates are still marginally open for that. I am not proud at all to report that my initial reaction to all of Barry and her friends' accusations were to say that they were all hogwash. Not because I had necessarily taken any real time to open my heart and my mind and examine them, but because it seemed to me from the depth and the warmth of my own academic ensconced position that the system was really something close to infallible, that the type of bias that Barry and her friends were describing, if true, would mean that really the system that I had spent so much time and emotional energy and other valuable limited resources cultivating is really fundamentally broken. And so I didn't want to see it. It took a very long time for me to sort of open my eyes. Again, it was a particularly, as repentance goes, this one was a particularly wholesome and wonderful process, because it ended up with me being, again, not just Barry's colleague, but good friend, and the same is true for a bunch of the other people on that initial endeavor. But in large part, this happened once I got to NYU and got a teaching position there at the Department of Media, Culture, and Communication, and had noticed that strange things were happening to me and all around me. They started off like every good horror movie. You know, if you're a fan of this particular genre, you know that you never really get to see the truly gruesome stuff in the first 10 minutes. You know, you have to sort of build up suspense. So the beginning was sort of like, you know, strange looks at faculty meetings and kind of weird little quips that I caught that I could almost swear were kind of directed at me. But then came a moment that was very instructive, in which one of my colleagues who mercifully, because again, Yom Kippur, et cetera, she'll remain nameless, decided to organize a seminar, which she said was a seminar on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Now that interested me a great deal, because I, you know, am a ninth generation Israeli, and a veteran of the Israeli army, and certainly someone who's been deeply politically active in Israel. And, you know, it struck me as the type of conversation that I would really benefit from participating in, and maybe also other people would benefit from my own perspective. And so I had written to this colleague, who, to be clear, did not advertise this seminar to me. I heard about it sort of through the grapevine, and asked if I could kindly, as a member of her department, come in and sit in on these meetings. And she, being a member of a very kind of high standing in the department, that, you know, I'm particularly enthused to start this conversation. To which I was told that the seminar was a closed seminar. It was somewhat of a strange answer that I didn't anticipate, and so I wrote back and said, well, I understand, right, limited participation, et cetera, but, you know, I'm a colleague, and, you know, maybe I could come for one or two sessions and have some conversations, and was then told in no uncertain terms that the seminar sort of presupposed a certain kind of worldview that, since I didn't share, that worldview being the absolute urgent pressing need for Israel to cease from existing right away, if possible. I am not invited. In fact, am officially unwelcome to sit down on the class. Now, the notion that academia was intended to or dedicated to anything but the free and unfettered exchange of ideas was still, to my very naive mind, kind of you know, an impossibility. And to hear that left me with a very deep wound and marked the beginning of the end for me, the beginning of my decision to disengage, despite having spent, you know, slightly more than a decade in the hallowed halls of academia, to disengage with it completely. After having done that, I focused much of my energy on reporting about academia, and in large part writing, having the pleasure of writing and editing stories by Asaf and some of you, I'm sure, on this call, and about some of the good works that you're doing. But I have to be honest here and say that the overall sort of sentiment that I have arrived at was pretty grim, was pretty chaotic. I tried to reason that not only was my decision to leave academia true for me, but in the classical grandiose fashion that again typifies too many of us who are paid to express their opinions in public, I argued, perhaps as a provocation, perhaps as a delusion, that the future of the entire academic pursuit is you know, rather an impossibility, or at the very least an unlikelihood. I would like to spend 2 minutes or 3 minutes about what led me to this line of thought before I promise you climbing on to higher plateaus and looking at sunnier, more cheerful and far more nuanced points of view. Looking at academia, I was struck not just by its ideological dips, which I will not talk at all about because all of you on this call know way more than me and are way more committed and insightful about these topics, but also by what struck me as some of the structural challenges that make the fight SPME and its members are having particularly difficult. I think that if we look at the numbers of what universities mean and how they see themselves, and I'm enough, you know, cognizant enough of my sort of good old-fashioned lefty roots all the way back in my youth to not completely dissolve or disassociate myself from sort of good materialistic arguments. But if you look at what happened to American higher education, you see all kinds of trends that should really worry you. Here are two by the numbers. Back in the olden ancient times of 2001, for example, the cost of a university education was 23% of median annual earnings, which is a lot, but you know, for many Americans, still manageable. If you had a job, you work hard, you know, you won't be surprised to hear that median annual earnings haven't risen much, but tuitions have exponentially, which is why in 2011, for example, university education cost 38% of the median annual income, and that number is above 40% right now. So 40% of earnings to pay for college. And while all that is happening, massive student loans that are now well above the $1 trillion mark is kind of abominable. Now, you may say, okay, well, you know, good stuff is always worth paying for. However, you know, one of my absolute favorite bits of trivia has to do with a recent federal survey of basically literacy among college grads. Literacy. Hold on, I have a definition here, which is really, really great. Here, the definition of literacy is using printed and written information to function in society, to achieve one's goals and develop one's knowledge and potential. That is, I believe, a 2017 survey. Only one quarter of college-educated adults were deemed proficient, meaning that the rest had just wasted a heck of a lot of time and money, which, again, you being in university won't necessarily, or still being kind of in academic positions, won't surprise you, if only because, you know, you are aware, again, much better than me, of how rapidly the landscape has changed. For example, to use just another great number, in 1969, which is not that long ago, 78% of all faculty members in American universities and colleges held tenure track positions, which is exactly as it should be if we believe that tenure is indeed this great big good that keeps us free from all other external pressures. The number now is only about 20%, which means that at the university where I taught, NYU, 55% of all classes are adjunct taught. In my own department, that number was almost 70%. And now, if you bear in mind that adjuncts can earn as little as $800 per month per class, you know, even the most well-meaning person who is dedicated and wants to give it them all, if you teach three classes, which is sort of a full load, you're earning $2,400 in a city where the average rent is $3,000. The whole system is geared towards anything but serious commitment to actual real cultivation of knowledge, and not to mention teaching, which makes it very vulnerable to all kinds of precisely the sort of ideological hucksters and hustlers that we see all around us, making commitments on behalf of nefarious, you know, hate-filled and biased ideas that are then very, very, very difficult for even the best-intentioned university president to stop. And so faced with all that, I wrote an article, the title of which was Get Out, that argued that no one should ever go to university anymore and that universities should, in fact, burn to the ground. I'm saying this with a pause for everyone to stop and smile at my silliness. It was always meant as a major provocation. I meant, of course, the very grim tone. But I also want to take this opportunity to share a great big of rabbinic wisdom that was taught to me by the former chief rabbi of England, Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. He said, you know, the difference between a prediction and a prophecy is that a prediction fails if it doesn't come true. A prophecy fails if it does. And so I'd like to think that my article about the failings of contemporary academia, of which, again, you are well aware, was not so much a prediction, but a prophecy. And it was a prophecy in the sense that I hope it doesn't come to fruition, which leads me back to SPME and everyone on this call today. The work being done by you guys, and I really cannot stress this enough, is so tremendously important precisely because it is so, it could feel, I know, I've, you know, indulging it myself here and there, so incredibly ungrateful, so incredibly repetitious, so incredibly against the grain, and so incredibly lonely, because so often, so many of us, you know, look out there for fellow scholars or administrators or professors or teachers who share our views, and simply don't find them. And so I want to end with a few hopeful notes. And the first is that, again, the existence of so much good work and so many small but significant victories suggests that maybe the doom and gloom scenario is way premature, and that there are still good fights to be had and meaningful changes to be made. The second is that the fact that there are so many of us, I wish there were hundreds more, but that there are even so many suggests that there is just a great big you know, phalanx of tremendous people who are committed to doing this kind of work. But the thing that makes me the most hopeful is the knowledge, which has been there with me from my very first step into a university ever. Which is simply this, that the work that we do isn't in the service, or I should really not take credit here, the work that you all do, is not in the service of some particular ideological bent or political spin or partisan passion. It is in the service of the very principles of what makes academia worthwhile and indeed important and indeed timeless, which is the undying, uncompromising commitment to the free and unfettered exchange of ideas in pursuit of something that is higher, that is timely and timeless alike. Now, here is what I know. I think that if you've read any bit of history, you know that this commitment never dies. It sometimes goes into hiding. It sometimes has to play defense. It sometimes has to disguise itself in order not to fall prey to the sort of ravenous forces of illogic. But it is always persistent, and in the end, it's always victorious. And so as we turn this into a conversation, I have to say only two things in conclusion, which is A, thank you for everything that you do, and B, this fight of ours, it's going to have a happy ending. And on that happy note, Asad, take us away.
Thank you for that. We appreciate everything, and thank you for the unpacking and the prolific analysis as always. So the floor is now open. And as I said before, if you have questions, please either raise your hand virtually or type in your question. I see a few questions already being typed in as we speak, and I will tackle them. Let me first start off by Alex. Why don't you give us start off the conversation and take the first prerogative, and we'll go from there.
Sure. Great. Well, thanks very much for your presentation. It's an interesting story. It's a great story. People end up in all sorts of places, having started someplace very, very different. I'm always reminded, and something that I once wrote a long time ago is that you can never be rich enough or cynical enough. And being of the age that I am, let me try and press you a little bit about what we should be doing with respect to our institutions specifically. I've been around too many donors and too many trustees, and I've seen the bamboozlement that people generate on themselves with regard to their institutions that they love so much and from which they got so much. And
right.
What would you do? What would you, if you were a trustee or a rich guy walking in?
Let me honor what I think is the spirit of the question by actually taking it from the opposite direction. Rather, not just what would I do if I were a trustee, which is a question I'm very happy to answer, but rather what would I do if I still were in academia, what I think is the work. I'd like to offer kind of like a glimpse into because I think they're actually sort of interlocking. I would honor three very important principles. The first, and again, I reach deep into my faith here. One thing that I love about it is that it actually makes prayer in solitude very, very difficult and ill-advised. I mean, things have changed sadly in the times of COVID, but prior to that, in order to pray, you had to pray in a quorum, in a minion of 10 people. And of those 10 people, it was almost guaranteed that there were at least three that you didn't like. I think what that teaches us is that these kinds of undertakings, the kind of undertakings that are truly, truly kind of world changing and character building and important, are only possible when practiced together, when practiced in a community. And so my first kind of inclination is to say, always build community, even with those people who see things slightly different than you. The narcissism of small differences cannot be stressed enough, especially, I'm sad to say, in our shared intellectual pursuits. So first of all, I would be very busy finding the people with whom I could fight the good fight. The second thing that I would do is be very mindful of the fact that students are like to think of, especially of millennials, as being kind of creatures formed on and shaped by social media, who come in and have these very strong personalities and ideas. But my experience, and perhaps yours too, teaches me that they're actually deeply not just impressionable, which, as you know, many young people are, but actually in need of something that they don't really receive, which is the kind of mentorship that presumes not the call to activism, but rather the indulgences of education. I think one reason why you hear so many students seem so unhappy right now is that they come in expecting one thing, which is the opportunity to truly engage in, exploration, and instead are told right away that there is a set of correct opinions and dogmas, and if they want to get by, they need to adopt them. And that's just never a nice thing, even if the ideas seem to you about right. So an investment in students can never be underplayed. And one thing that broke my heart and continues to break my heart is the seeming, again, I speak only from my experience, which is all I could do, but the seeming real disregard for teaching as part of an academic life. When I accepted my position, I was told almost apologetically that I would have to teach 3 classes a semester. And I said, why do you have this tone of voice? He said, well, you know, it's a lot, and you do this for a couple of semesters, and then we promise you the teaching load is negotiable. And I said, well, you know, you do realize this is what I came here for. I would like 5 classes. I mean, this is the whole essence of the thing to me. I want to spend time with the students. I want to spend time having these discussions, exploration. This is, in fact, what a university is for. I think that attitude is sadly not altogether too common and needs to grow. Finally, I think it's the understanding that the that what we seek is not necessarily always going to look and feel like what we thought it would look and feel going in. By which I mean to say, all of us, I assume, on this call, like me, had very particular notions of what academia is and what academic life will be. That's why we made a decision to go into it. And it is very difficult for some of us to negotiate the possibility of certain kinds of our certain aspects of our life happening outside of academia. And yet we discover that when scholars leave the quad and leave the campus, not permanently, you know, not a kind of blaze of glory, but rather by writing for publications that are popular rather than necessarily peer-reviewed or academic, by engaging in projects like starting podcasts or writing kind of mass market books, or joining groups and associations that are devoted to ideas and not necessarily just to professional practices. They could sometimes have tremendous, 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 tremendous impact. You know, I don't want to evoke a name here that may provoke all sorts of different opinions. But one of my kind of strangest and most joyful occurrences was walking, again, back when you could still walk down the street about a year ago, and seeing a very long line of people outside the Beacon Theater on the Upper West Side of New York. There were young people who were all kind of well-dressed and looked like they were very excited to be there. And I asked one of them, you know, who are you waiting for? And they said, well, we're waiting for an evening with Jordan Peterson. And I said to myself, oh, Lord, you know, here are hundreds, if not thousands of people who paid $30 each to hear a professor speak. There is hope for us all yet. And so to kind of shift right now very briefly, if I were a very wealthy donor, I would A, explore alternative infrastructures, both within and without universities, that allowed the people who are still committed to the spirit of university to practice their trade. I would invest heavily in anything that rewarded real teaching and engagement with students on levels that are beyond simply like, and now you will parrot to me all the, you know, slogans that I just gave you. And I would also invest heavily in anything that allowed for sort of real and non-oppressive communities of like-minded scholars to come together and find some respite from the increasingly alienated world of academia.
Great. Thank you for that. Alex, if it's okay, I'm going to move on to a few questions that we have here on the chat.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So thank you for that, Leo. So there are a few questions that I'm going to try to combine, into one, that relate to the connection between the academy and obviously the Jewish community and Jewish involvement at large. One, of course, you know, if you could a little bit, unpack a little bit the connection between the Jewish community and the academy, related to that, our my friend and colleague Charles Jacobs, who's here on the call, is also asking, he's already, talking about, what we've seen, of course, is it related to the failure of the establishment to defend Israel on campus is, you know, the larger kind of as far as how long this has been taking place and the amount of Jews on campus and what we have suffered. And connected to that, but, you know, obviously related is, of course, you know, a question by Marv is really, as a result of the environment that we're facing, how do Jewish parents navigate when they're looking at university? How do they apply to campuses? What they're going to be looking for, especially with the pandemic? Obviously, we know that the bias and the anti-Semitism does not stop COVID or not. And so how do you kind of navigate these issues when we're talking about the campuses being the front line and the amount of involvement that the Jewish community at large has invested from a intellectual standpoint, from a financial standpoint in the academy, and I guess the returns, or at times, to Alex's point, some of the lack of returns, you know, as far as the skepticism and the reality that we're seeing today.
Only that.
I'm just trying to combine a little bit of the common themes here as far as the questions. I know there are they're all lectures onto their own, but if you could try to tackle some of those points.
I'm going to do my best here. First of all, really good to know that Charles Jacobs is on the line. Charles was one of the forces behind this effort that I mentioned in my opening remarks, and I've since made my apologies privately to him too. He was, of course, completely right. I was completely wrong. I'll start with that part of the question about understanding the failure of the Jewish establishment, because I think it also leads in very nicely into the sort of understanding where so many Jewish parents are today. Look, in part, it's a very understandable story. If you sort of look at least a very kind of facile, somewhat glib version of the American Jewish history of the last 60, 70 years, it's a history of assimilation, of becoming comfortable, of growing wealthy. In large part, that was achieved precisely through the good auspices of academic institutions. There is a reason why I came to this country, and the first thing that I thought about wasn't, you know, hey, I'm gonna go, you know, buy myself a pushcart and sell, you know, hot dogs until I could make, you know, $1 million. It was, hey, you know, I'm going to go to university and get sort of accredited into the elite or into the academic kind of, you know, social, national milieu that I wanted to be a part of that way. And the reason I thought this way, the reason so many Jews still think this way, is because it was for the longest time true. It is a very hard thing for any one person, not to mention one organization, to observe reality with sufficient dispassion and sufficient kind of sobriety to understand when a particular historical moment has ended and when a particular institution has served its purpose, especially when that moment and that institution has done so much to elevate you, your family, and everyone you know. And so I don't want to sound particularly critical. However, if you look at the record, here's the record. And again, Charles here knows very well about these things. He's done and is doing, holy work about some of these things. You look at institutions, Jewish institutions, that are very eager to not just look the other way, but really see themselves as part of this whole different class of people that still very much revolves around academic accreditation. I think it is a particular plight, and again, I don't want to get too deep or too heavy here, but I think it's a particular plight of our specific meritocratic moment that values these accreditations so highly without ever stopping to ask what it is that they actually give us or teach us or provide us with. And in order to be a part of this, what seems to be a fabulous party, these institutions are willing to overlook the kind of outright bigotry that, if applied to literally any other minority in America, these very institutions would mobilize fiercely and ferociously against. It's easy to see this as a partisan failing, and I think there's sadly truth to that. But at the same time, I think it is more than anything else, it is basically the result of some deep-seated anxiety, which makes the transition. I want to speak about parents now, because I think this anxiety is felt on an individual level as well. I think even now, even well aware of all these failings that members of SPME work so diligently to alert Jewish readers about, if you ask most Jewish parents who have sons and daughters who are, say, aged 13 to 17, you know, what the greatest thing they can imagine for their young ones, they would likely say very close to the top, for you know, young Jimmy or young Janice to get it to Princeton or Harvard or Yale. That to me is indicative of a tremendous failure of imagination, because it is almost, I mean, to be blunt and provocative here, it's almost child abuse. You know, we give our kids too often very little by way of education about anything consisting of real Jewish history, Jewish identity, Jewish ethos, let alone any kind of real sense of pride, and then we sent them off to the ideological killing fields of Harvard, and they kind of encounter tremendous abuse from their peers and from their professors, and we praise them because, hey, they're in Harvard all the while not seeing that they're not getting anything that nears an actual real education, and also not coming to terms with the fact that even that education is far less meaningful, or the accreditation rather is far less meaningful now than it's ever been. And so I think on that realm, one of the great fights that we should fight is, and I see here in the questions that Charles also asked, you know, how can we go on the offensive? I think we go on the offensive not only by fighting the institutions, but by helping parents and Jewish organizations sort of wake up to the reality that these things are happening, and that it is absolutely our sacred duty, at the very least, not to take part in the abuse. Fine, maybe you still do the math and make the calculus that Princeton degree is beneficial, but you don't have to sort of excuse any of this, partake any of it. You certainly don't have to give large sums of money to endow buildings and programs, and you're certainly not exempt from holding these institutions accountable, and also providing your sons and your daughters with the mental, the moral, the intellectual, and the emotional tools that they would need to honestly and successfully face the onslaught that you know they're going to face.
Great, thank you for that. So there are a few other questions here that I tackle also as well, Leo. Obviously, one question that that BB has here, Gertisman, I guess and you can tell me if you don't want to tackle this or talk more in generalities about this. But diving into your personal story, was your role, your position at NYU, was it a tenure track? Was it not? Was that any kind of contributing factor as well to your leaving the academy, and how that played into looking at the academy, in general, as far as
talk about that. So I came in as a visiting professor. Did a 3-year tour of duty. My big thing, and again, it's so funny because I'm unlike so many people on this call, I'm not a scholar of anything particularly political. My PhD is in human-machine interaction. My area of research is video games and ontology, right? And so I came in and I started doing all these research projects and working with companies like Codecademy and Time Warner and really kind of enjoying the possibilities there. First of all, got a lot of pushback right then and there. People would say things like, oh, you just arranged a very big internship program. Don't you think it's problematic that you're in bed with big business? To which I would reply, don't you think it's problematic that you graduate 850 kids every year that each pay you $64,000 without once stopping to think what these kids actually do with this degree that you're providing them with under some kind of, you know, tacit promise that they're actually going to find meaningful, remunerative work out there. I had the misfortune and the displeasure of seeing the beginnings of intersectionality and critical race theory and all these things that, you know, we are now hearing about far more prominently. This was, you know, now about a decade ago, so this was still somewhat early days, at least for me. I gave a talk at some point, and it mentioned the Phaedrus, and I got the sense that talking about Plato, I might have Sieg Heiled and praised Hitler, because to some of my colleagues in this room, there was really no difference, because all white men, all thinkers who are not, you know, people of color or minorities or otherwise affiliated with the group of the divinely elect were equally evil. This came, all this process sort of percolated slowly. It came to a job, sort of a tenure track position application. It was me, the finalists were me and another candidate. I remember these numbers accurately because they amuse me to no end, and I think of them frequently. There are 28, I believe, people who voted on this particular position. 26 of them voted against me. 2 voted for me. And the subsequent lunch with my 2 colleagues who thought that I should receive this particular position was actually, you know, it was very charming, because, you know, they were crestfallen and felt as if they needed to comfort me and sort of console me, because I had just suffered this great loss. But I had by then already come to realize that this path is, if it was at all possible for someone of my disposition, was much, much, much too onerous, and that I could do a lot of the same work that I'd always wanted to do outside of academia. Might things have been different if I was a bit more attuned to the rules? Might have they been different if I wasn't at a university like NYU and a department like media, culture, and communication that were really early adopters, or I should say early patients of this particular form of inflammation? Quite likely, yes. However, I'm actually quite grateful for it because it gave me the kind of lesson that I clearly desperately needed.
And you're a better person for it, right?
1,000%. And again, it not only continued my own process of education, which began in the dark days of Columbia and culminated in really, I think, having learned a truly profound and worthwhile lesson, which, like all profound and worthwhile lessons, was bought or paid for by much trial, error, suffering, blood, sweat, and tears. But also, again, alerted me to the existence of this wonderful community of people, which is way more, we know this from the outside, it may seem a bit strange, way more diverse than people think, and committed, again, not just to some kind of rah-rah, we support Israel because, you know, we're Jews and we think it could do no wrong or anything like that, although that might certainly be true and fine, but rather because we identify this blindly bigoted, this rabid assault on Israel and its very right to exist. We truly understand it to be what I believe it is, which is really the canary in the coal mine that signifies the absolute death of reason and the rise of a crazed, dark, anti-Semitic, profoundly anti-American system of thought that we simply cannot afford. So even if a person has no real feelings about or commitment to Israel, this is a fight that all of us must share, because not winning it really means that we lose one of the greatest institutions that have truly made America great and will continue to do so.
Great. So a segue to that question. I mean, this is, you know, a little bit, you know, related to what you were talking about now. You know, I'm going to go into, you know, another question. You know, we got it on the chat by Avi Green, but I want to kind of expand a little bit on it, you know. So Avi's asking more about your recent research on comic books and Marvel, you know, and the how part of the propaganda has seeped into, you know, social justice, into that realm of film industry and whatnot. You know, obviously Alex and I, and of course Julio, have all written about the how, you know, obviously what starts in the academy doesn't end in the academy or begins in the academy. There is a larger cultural problem that, as you point out correctly, relates to anti-Americanism, anti-Westernism. You know, maybe you want to expand a little bit about, you know, obviously Stan Lee was Jewish, and you wrote a lot about, you know, in the great book you recently put out. But maybe talk about the gaps and where you saw some of this bias and anti-Semitism play out, and how you see it. Is there a way to carve it out? And really, you know, related to your point about millennials, and I know I'm saying, you know, adding a little bit more, that could be another lecture, but, you know, these are icons of the day. And if you're talking about how the younger generation is being influenced by these influencers vis-a-vis this medium, how do we carve that? How do we deal with social media and anti-Semitism as that, you know, has become a vehicle within the educational process?
Bless you. I love this. I mean, I'm laughing because I really, you know, wish that we could just carve out the rest of the day and just, you know, kind of lay back and have these conversations. I first of all, I think what you identified is very true, and here too you could see the change happening so drastically and so radically. I mean, if you look at someone like Stan Lee, Stan Lee was a figure that we all would recognize as a sort of good run-of-the-mill, middle-of-the-road, you know, American Jewish liberal. He was interested in exploring all kinds of social issues that he saw in his comic books. sometimes he was more successful in doing it in a way that was actually artistically interesting. Sometimes he did it in a way that was, you know, felt a little bit clunky and preachy, but no one walked away from a Stan Lee era comic book feeling like they were reading, you know, an issue of Pravda. You know, nobody felt like they were being hit over the head. It was simply a kind of a product of a particular moment in time. I think that changed radically. It changed. You know, you could start the timer at any number of moments in the last 5 to maybe 15 years. But we got to the point that, as we see with the recent and preposterous decision by the Academy of Motion Pictures to basically make some kind of commitment to social justice and racial diversity a requirement for Best Picture, we see an abandonment of the grander commitment, the human commitment at the core of all these pursuits, be it art, be it academia, be it literature, which is a commitment to truth and beauty, which is an understanding that being human, nothing human is foreign to us, which is a passion to explore ideas, even or particularly if they take us outside of any real comfort zone, and to eschew at the very outset any and all demands for ideological, you know, conformity or partisan commitment. That we lost this is a very significant loss. I could tell you again on a confession, since I started on a confessional note, we might as well end on a confessional note. I am now blissfully detached from pretty much any and every popular culture product, which for a guy who wrote a book about Stan Lee and has a PhD in video games, you can imagine is a really it's not an easy undertaking. These are things that I love. I'm, for example, obsessed with baseball and seeing the pageantry of, you know, the Black Lives Matter movement before, during, and after every game made me that much less inclined to want to watch the games. Because, again, I believe that if you live in a society that it can afford you no realm that is outside of the dominant ideology of the ruling class, you don't really live in a truly free society. And so, on a personal note, I am revolted by this and completely eager to disconnect from it. But on a collective note, I think that a huge part of the fight ahead, and this is why I sort of hinted to the importance of people on this call and people who are simpatico with us, sort of stepping outside, you know, into the world at large, because what this moment in time means for us is that we have to start building everything from scratch. Our culture is like Dresden in 1945. Everything has been decimated and firebombed. Every institution that we once had is lost to us. And so now we need to rebuild it, or if we can't, abandon it and come up with alternatives. That means media, television, literature, music. That is a huge, 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 huge undertaking on the one hand. On the other hand, if you look at any juncture in history in which similar moments of transition occurred, the rebirth that comes out of the ashes is always magnificent and well worth the trouble.
Well, thank you. That's we hope for that kind of rebuilding. Alex, how about I let you know, just being cognizant of the time, I let you have the last question of the day. Alex?
Yeah, I'm here. Am I there?
Yeah, you're here.
Okay. Well, I think I can't help but agree with you and your assessment of the situation and your description of where we're at. The term I always use for the direction we're going actually comes from 30 Rock, where, you know, one of the characters describes how he fell down into a crevasse on a glacier and he came out through the bottom. And I think that's where we're going to have to go. But I do think that having a clear sense of the kinds of institutions that will pick up the slack in this rebuilding phase or in the next phase, whatever it's going to look like, would be very useful. So I'll give you an example. I live out here in Westchester, and there was a small college in my town that went bust, a small matter of embezzlement and not paying taxes. But it has a beautiful, beautiful campus, 20 minutes from the train station. And if I were a fabulously rich individual, I would have bought that for 30 million bucks, paid the back taxes, and set up a small liberal arts college geared towards the 21st century.
Hallelujah.
The future. So that's another opportunity on my part that was missed. But I want to go back also to something that you said at the beginning, and that really is very emblematic. Your career, maybe mine as well, is very, very emblematic that you can do valuable things, including scholarship, including being a public intellectual outside of the university environment. And I read all the time in the academia trade journals the panic about what do we do with all these PhDs who parenthetically can't write, can't speak. Most of them don't think that well either. But the idea that there is life after academia, and that there is, in fact, there are alternate paths besides academia for kids graduating from high school, and there may be alternate paths to the things that we call high school as well. The number of kids who are being homeschooled during this catastrophic pandemic year is is enormous. Most of the kids, certainly in the spring. And these are opportunities that we shouldn't miss, and we shouldn't go back to the dull, if nothing else, dull and dysfunctional ways of doing things after this catastrophic year is over, and encouraging students and parents, and Jewish students and parents in particular, to think creatively and act creatively with, first and foremost, with their kids, but also with their money, and also with their reputations as leaders in society is very important. So if we can all lead the way, not necessarily to the extinction, but the reformation, a very carefully chosen term, of academia and what it means in American life and in global life going forward.
So I sadly have a 2 o'clock Zoom that I absolutely have to jump on. So I'll be very brief, which is all the same, because really all I have to say to everything you just said is amen selah. I, by the way, don't see it at all as a reformation, which is historically a term that I'm, you know, somewhat kind of itchy about. Rather, I see it as a refounding. It's a recommitment to the foundational values. And precisely because it is a recommitment to the foundational values, and precisely because so many of our purported colleagues have abandoned precisely these skill sets that made us, you know, that made this institution what it is, the ability to write, the ability to argue, the ability to think, only means that the people who still know how to do these things are at a premium, at a much higher demand than ever before. Whether or not that demand manifests itself in a traditional tenure track position at the University of so-and-so, maybe not, but that is hardly the question that we should focus on. I think the question we should focus on, and then I will say again my thanks and express my admiration for SBME and its good work, but the question that we should focus on is the same passion, the same drive that led us back when we were young to pursue this life, the commitment to the free and unfettered exchange of ideas. That is what we continue to do. And as long as we continue to do it, we will not only just win, but also really be on the side that connects with what people desire and with what people respond to, because that is a force that is greater than any number of malicious ideologues can ruin.
Great. Well, thank you for that, Leo. I know you have to run, but, you know, so, you know, I won't keep you, but I want to, again, publicly thank you again for taking the time to talk to us this afternoon. Alex, as always, thank you for joining me. And I want to thank, of course, everybody who has been able to join us, and I appreciate everybody's flexibility. I know there are several questions we did not get to. If we, you know, you could always email us at bdsmonitor@spme.org. We'll do our best to get to them and answer them, you know, in a timely fashion as well. But Liel, above all, really, I want to thank you, and I look forward to continuing our collective conversation going forward. So thank you again.
As we say in Yiddish, inshallah. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So thank you. Bye-bye. Again, thank you, everybody, and have a great afternoon. I hope everybody is staying safe and healthy. And please look out for our next call, which will take place next week. Notices will be going out in the next few days again. And we look forward to continuing the conversation. Alex, again, thank you. And everybody have a good afternoon.